And we're not seeing any results. So it's starting to get really frustrating being one of the people out here that's talking about all this stuff and seeing really not much for activity with it.
I think peer pressure is probably one of the biggest issues with change in agriculture. I have a lot of guys that will tell me in the corner of the room, say, I like what you're doing, it makes sense, but I can't do that because they'll make fun of me.
Yeah, I mean, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, right? And so for the last 15 years, every major leader in the state from whatever industry group or politician has just been emphatic about, you know, voluntary change is the best way to go, blah, blah, blah. Well, show me the data that suggests that.
Welcome to the 395th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. Over the years, this podcast has tended to focus on the positive role a more regenerative farm and food system can play in cleaning up our water, building soil health, producing healthy food, and supporting rural economies. Fortunately, through the work LSP is doing on soil health, supporting the next generation of farmers, building community-based food systems, and advancing policy that supports the public good, I've had the opportunity to interview literally hundreds of farmers and others who are proving such a sustainable form of agriculture is possible. But to be honest, the people who have shared their stories with me still represent an extremely small proportion of agriculture. For example, despite advances in innovative farming systems, countless field days and workshops, and a ton of money directed at paying farmers to establish soil-friendly practices, the USDA estimates only around 5% of U.S. ag acres are regularly cover-cropped, and less than 40% of corn acres are managed using no-till systems. In Minnesota, only 5% of total crop acres are no-tilled, and cover crops are planted on less than 3% of ag lands in any given year, according to one University of Minnesota estimate. As I drive across farm country in the upper Midwest, I'm struck at how much black, exposed soil I'm seeing between November and May. So, despite significant progress in the areas of conservation since the 1930s era Dust Bowl, erosion rates are still at unsustainable levels. A University of Massachusetts study concluded that one-third of the Corn Belt has lost the entire A horizon due to tillage erosion. The A horizon is the organic matter-enriched topsoil layer. The decimation of that topsoil is causing an average 6% crop yield reduction and an estimated annual economic loss of $2.8 billion. And soil isn't the only thing leaving the land at unsustainable rates. Consider nitrogen fertilizer, for example. When it escapes farm fields and evolves into nitrate, this mainstay of corn production becomes a major contaminant of drinking water in the Midwest. One testing program found that 10% of private wells sampled in parts of Minnesota had nitrate levels above the Environmental Protection Agency's safe drinking water limit. According to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, 70% of nitrate pollution in Minnesota comes from commercial fertilizer escaping cropland. Given cover cropping's proven effectiveness at keeping nitrates out of water, one can see why we'd like to see more continuous living cover established in farm country. Perhaps the poster child for how nitrate pollution can cause major drinking water problems is Des Moines, Iowa. There, the Central Iowa Water Works has been forced to install an expensive nitrate filtration system as a result of farm runoff. For a time in 2025, the Water Works was forced to ration water because the filtration system couldn't keep up with all the nitrates present as a result of a fertilizer-heavy planting season. Even more troubling, in January of this year, the filtration system was activated. Having to turn on the filtration system during the winter shows levels of nitrates in the agricultural watersheds that supply the waterworks are literally off the charts. Meanwhile, the Iowa Farm Bureau issued a public statement a few months ago claiming that water pollution in the state is getting better, not worse, and that's a sign that a voluntary approach to adopting farm conservation practices is working. Understandably, natural resource scientists, environmentalists, and local government officials are concerned about the negative impact an industrialized approach to farming is having on our water and soil. But I recently had a conversation with three farmers who are also pretty upset about the state of the soil and water and are frustrated with the lack of progress we're making. So frustrated, in fact, that they're very willing to speak out. Zach Smith, James Hepp, and Matt Borman all raise corn and soybeans in north central Iowa, just a couple hours drive upstream from Des Moines. James is 35 and Matt and Zach are in their 40s. They all study agriculture in college and have been very active in mainstream ag groups like the Iowa Farm Bureau. Zach worked for a time selling chemicals and seed, so he's seen that side of the business as well. In other words, they check a lot of boxes when it comes to the so-called typical Midwestern crop farmer. But they are also passionately committed to utilizing farming systems that build the kind of soil health that reduces erosion, saves money on chemical inputs, and in general, makes their farms more resilient economically and environmentally. They utilize cover crops as well as conservation tillage systems like no-till and strip-till, and have received public recognition for their conservation efforts. In addition, they're big believers in applying just the right amount of nitrogen fertilizer that their crops need to be productive. Some of their methods are pretty sophisticated. For example, there's something called a sap test, which measures the nutrient levels, including minerals, sugars, and proteins, in the plant's vascular tissues. Based on the test results, a farmer can apply fertilizer in a more targeted way via side dressing or other methods. Rather than relying on front-loading a bunch of fertilizer before the growing season and hoping at least some of it gets taken up and used by the crop. That's important, given that almost 30% of nitrogen applied as commercial fertilizer or manure is not taken up by the plants. One estimate is that in the U.S., on average, over 34 pounds of nitrogen is lost on each cultivated crop acre per year. These three farmers call themselves the strip-till mafia because of their devotion to conservation tillage. But they also have a moniker that recognizes and honors the region they farm in, the Loeb Rangers. The Des Moines Loeb is the geological name of a landform that was created thousands of years ago when the last glaciers receded from north central Iowa. That milling ice left behind some of the richest soil in the world. That, combined with the fact that the landscape is pretty much flat as a billiard table, helps explain why corn and soybean production dominates here. The Loeb Rangers are extremely concerned that we are squandering this vital resource by not implementing basic soil health practices on a widespread basis. In fact, an Iowa State University analysis showed that while some Midwestern counties are seeing an increase in the use of no-till cropping, in recent years, Matt and Zach's home counties have been nearly stagnant in this area. That troubles these farmers on multiple levels, since they see a direct connection between poor soil management, the economic devastation of rural communities, and polluted water both at home and in their state's capital city. These three farmers are quite willing to vocalize their concerns, which I appreciate. I can vouch for the fact that they are not alone. Over the years, I've spoken privately to plenty of farmers who have a similar level of frustration when it comes to the lack of conservation present on the landscape and how the ag industry, the government, our educational institutions, and mainstream commodity groups are not tackling the problem head on. But for various reasons, few farmers are willing to be public with their concerns. Zach, James, and Matt represent an important voice in the debate about how to make Midwestern agriculture more resilient economically and environmentally. These are farmers who are committed to soil health, but are also very much reliant on producing the two row crops, corn and soybeans, that so many of their neighbors raise. Like other farmers I've interviewed, they're proving that in order to make significant advances in building soil health and reducing water pollution, a few key tweaks here and there can make a big difference. They acknowledge that a cropping system reliant on more diverse rotations will have a major positive impact. And in fact, James and Zach both raise oats. But they also know that the reality of the situation is that, for the foreseeable future, corn and beans dominate the ag landscape in this region. And thus, we need to figure out how to make those crops more sustainable. On a wintry morning in December, I met with the Loeb Rangers in Matt's cavernous machine shed just a few miles from the east branch of the Des Moines River. In the first part of a two-part podcast, the three farmers talk about why, after all the resources and lip service devoted to conservation farming over the years, our problems seem to be getting worse. How something as relatively simple as adjusting the timing of fertilizer applications could have huge water quality benefits, and why the voluntary approach to implementing conservation practices just isn't working. In the next episode, we'll talk about the role markets and mainstream farm groups could play in a more regenerative approach to farming, and why most farmers are hesitant to speak out when it comes to what they're seeing happen on the land. In that episode, we'll also address the so-called urban-rural divide, as well as the elephant in the room, what role regulation can play in finally making concrete changes on the landscape. Before we get into this interview, I want to explain a few technical terms that some folks may not be familiar with. For example, we talk a fair bit about anhydrous ammonia. This is a form of nitrogen-based fertilizer that's often applied on crop fields in the fall after harvest. If you're driving in a rural area and see white torpedo-like containers sitting on wheels in farm fields, you're likely looking at anhydrous ammonia tanks. It is highly recommended that when anhydrous ammonia is applied in the fall, farmers wait until soil temperatures are cool enough to reduce biological activity and thus cut the amount of fertilizer that's lost to the environment. By the way, it turns out nitrous oxide escaping into the atmosphere is a significant greenhouse gas. The other topic that's brought up in this interview is federally subsidized crop insurance. This USDA program was originally started to shield farmers from being put out of business as a result of weather disasters. It's still an important safety net, but in recent decades, it's evolved into a program that provides outsized benefits to some of the largest cropping operations in the country. Studies show that as it's implemented now, crop insurance actually encourages poor soil management practices and has contributed to consolidation of farms. It's another example of a well-intentioned, tax-funded initiative actually working against the public good. Also, one other note. At the start of this interview, Zach Smith speaks first, followed by James Hepp second and Matt Borman third. Okay, after the longest podcast intro in history, sorry about that, folks. Finally, here's the first part of our interview. So, you guys have been very, in your own ways, have been very public about concerns about water quality and its relationship to agriculture. And I think that's some of the incentive for you guys looking into soil health practices, that kind of thing. But I also know just from some of the stuff I've been seeing about you guys and some other conversations I've had with you that you're very frustrated with the situation we have with agriculture, particularly here in Iowa and this part of the Midwest, and water quality. I guess one of the questions I have, I've been around long enough to see so many supposed innovations in making agriculture more water-friendly come and go, tons of research, and innovations in agriculture itself that were going to be the kind of silver bullet for this. I guess I'd like to talk to you guys about why is the problem, I get a sense that you guys would agree with this statement, that actually the problem has gotten worse. I guess, first of all, is that true? Do you feel like it's gotten worse? And if so, why? What, from your perspective as farmers and people who are very aware of this issue, and why has it gotten worse?
I think it's gotten worse because the style of farming that we're evolving into with all of the consolidation oftentimes falls into the largest operations consuming acres that come up and available. And when you are farming large amounts of acres, the way that our operations farm is tougher to achieve because it's more complicated. It's not as fast. The management of it is at a lot higher bar. And so, also the demographics of farming where you have, a majority of the farmers in late 50s to 60s, 70s, they're not at the age where they're wanting to, change and try new things. I know the older I get, the less I am that way, and so I empathize with that position. You know, those factors of where are the acres going, they're going into the largest farms where it's tougher to integrate these things, and you have a lot of old people still holding on to acres that aren't interested in change. And I think that's why we see the trend of it, getting worse instead of getting better. In our opinion, this volunteer action, mantra that a lot of politicians and leaders talk about, I think has been an abject failure, expecting people to volunteer to do some of these things, just given where the industry is headed and the demographics, is kind of a fool's errand, in my opinion.
Any thoughts on that, James?
Yeah, I think it kind of boils down to convenience, too. As operators get bigger, the stuff we do takes management. You have to go out, and there's some days you go to the field and say, well, we can't do it today. Where if you went and did two or three tillage passes, you could have planted that day. So I think convenience is a lot of it. They're getting bigger. Like Zach said, the older you get, you probably don't want to change. And I I would agree with that too. But like I said, everywhere you look, they just more and more, and it's just easy too. Because when you're doing heavy tillage, it doesn't take a lot of experience. You can almost put anybody in that tillage tool. Where if you're strip tilling or doing stuff like that, you know, you need to get out and check, look at stuff, and so it goes back to the management piece, I think.
Yeah.
And you just got to keep getting bigger, they think. So.
What about you, Matt?
There's also a lack of effort to even try anything different. There's innovators in all the communities, but if you have one innovator that's trying, you know, trying cover crops on 80 acres, and that innovator is surrounded by 2,000 acres that have been disc ripped and pulverized, you know, and you get a 5-inch rain in an afternoon, that one 80-acre farm of cover crops is not going to save anything. And I think the frustration from some of us that are doing cover crops, strip-till cover crops, that are trying to innovate and do things better on our farm, is that we get propped up by some of these ag groups. And so we've done enough newspaper articles, magazine articles, trying to get more people. This shop has hosted 3 field days already, and it was built new in 2021. And we're not seeing any results. So it's starting to get really frustrating being one of the people out here that's talking about all this stuff and seeing really not much for activity with it. And you can lay out all the economic reasons that you want, and you just don't see any action with it. And a lot of farmers kind of follow the crowd, you know. They follow the crowd on what the newest tillage tool from Case IH or John Deere is, or what the latest 4-track tractor that has 700 to 800 horsepower. You know, they're all about that, but ways that they could save more money through better nutrient application or placement, it's like they just ignore it. Talk about anhydrous. When I planted my first crop in 2001, that time period, it was faux pas to put on anhydrous. You never seen any anhydrous bars running in the fall until about mid-November. Mm-hmm. And if you went in early, let's say the first week of November to the co-op, you were almost ashamed of yourself to even start that. And now we're watching anhydrous get put on mid-October. We've backed up anhydrous dates or forwarded it a full month. We're watching anhydrous get put on. And also some of the tiling and what's been going on with farms in the last 20 to 25 years that I've been farming, it used to be an 80-acre farm would have like a main tile with maybe 2, 3, 5 branches rolling off of it. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't put anhydrous on. If you put it on in the fall, it wasn't until mid-November. Well, now we've got more pattern tile drainage. A lot, way more drainage than we used to have, and we're bringing all of our nutrients. We're more front loading that, which is it's getting flushed out of the tile line. So we want to keep agriculture abundant and vibrant. And some of the things that we could talk about today are going to help farmers make more money. There's a lot of hope with this because we can have really good crops and put on nutrients closer to when the crop needs it, and it just equals making more money. It's a wonderful, it's a great opportunity right now for farms that are suffering, you know, not making very good profit right now, you know, with the low commodity prices.
I want to back up a little bit on that, how they're putting on the anhydrous earlier and early. Is that because they're just managing so many more acres that they need more of a window to get that all in the fall?
I think it's become culturally acceptable. I think back to when we used to try to pull like a 13-knife anhydrous bar on a 150-horse tractor to 200-ish horse tractor. You didn't even want to admit to any of your friends that you were even thinking about anhydrous. You didn't even think about anhydrous in October.
Yeah.
And you wanted to push that off until roughly the 15th of November, till the end of November. Guys would put it on until it would freeze up. And a lot of the bars would literally freeze up in somebody's yard, and you'd limp them back to the co-op, or you'd start again in the spring. And now it's like, get it on, get the anhydrous on. And the company selling additives and inhibitors and stuff can go along with that because, well, they could sell a product to help it release slower. But anytime you could put anhydrous on in a t-shirt, that's not scientifically sound to do. And I don't want to bash on anhydrous because I think if it's put on right, it's going to be okay. But we just keep backing, you know, we just keep front-loading that date. And I'm watching people that would have never put anhydrous on 20 years ago in October. It's like they just don't care anymore. But the fact of the matter is they don't have to care. There's no teeth or any rules that, you know, require you to do it one way or another.
The other point I wanted to make on the why it's happening more is because the amount of custom application that the elevators now provide is way more than what it was 20 years ago.
Okay.
So you look at the demographic of a 65-year-old farmer that says, hey, I don't want to wait for my nitrogen to get applied ahead of my planter next year. Why don't you just have call the co-op and just have them go out there, and I don't even have to deal with it. Somebody else will go out and do it. And there's a lot more custom, you know, big custom operations from these, you know, co-ops that will just take care of it for you. And they market it that way. Get the nitrogen out of the way. I mean, I literally saw a Facebook post from co-ops, you know, saying, let us take care of your nitrogen needs in the fall so that it's easier for you. You can go faster in the spring, you know. And these are the institutions that are supposed to have agronomists that are 4-hour certified and all this other nonsense.
CCAs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Too. I think that's, and that was a question I wanted to talk about later, but let's address it now because I think it dovetails with this discussion, is the role that input suppliers, co-ops play in all of this, because they have kind of a conflict of interest here as far as, even if it's not, frankly, good financially for the farmer, let alone for the environment, they have an incentive to sell as much as they can and to be providing those services as early as they can and as long as they can to extend that season, keep their equipment busy, all of that. I mean, that seems to be a big issue.
Yeah, I mean, they're a logistics business, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the industry is not equipped to apply nitrogen correctly because we're equipped now to spread it out over a 9-month period, mm-hmm. instead of really condensing it in my opinion, when it should be, which is in the spring, to avoid, you know, the losses that we get early in the spring. And so if you're an agronomy manager, they've got to balance that and answer to the board, you know, on dealing with that reality. You know, the other piece is if they do take a stand and say, you know, we're going to be responsible and we're not going to let anhydrous out the door until what Matt said, the 15th of November, well, then the farmer will get pissed and go down the road and say,
yeah.
And I've literally had conversations with, you know, agronomy managers of major co-ops here on the Des Moines Lobe that say, we know what the right thing is to do, but competitively, we've got to sell tons,
yeah.
you know, because we answer to the board, and this is a business, and so that's a real issue.
I think peer pressure is another thing with earlier and earlier. I mean, it's like in the spring, you see a neighbor go by with the planter, and you're just like running around
right.
like a hamster in a yeah. wheel, you know, and so if the neighbor Johnny's putting in anhydrous on, oh boy, I should be doing it. So I think peer pressure is probably one of the biggest issues with change in agriculture. I have a lot of guys that will tell me, in the corner of the room, say, I like what you're doing, it makes sense, but I can't do that because they'll make fun of me. And these are like 60-year-old guys or stuff like that. So it's kind of like Matt said, everything you, all these practices will net you more money. I mean, I had an experienced farmer. He's always giving me a hard time because I'm in the local like papers quite a bit and stuff. And he said, quote unquote, I understand the net bushels, but more bushels is, or net income, but more bushels is more important to me. Because I told him, I said, you know, you could change a few things on your operation. You might lose 5 bushel an average, maybe. But in the backside, you should be able to change your ways and gain that back with foliar and right apply. But say you lost 5 bushels, I guarantee you'd make way more money. Because he's doing 3 tillage passes, probably another 50, 60 pounds of N. I said, what happens if you could do subtract all that and have like 5 bushel less? Well, I understand that. Net's important, but more bushels is more important to me. So that's kind of the mentality. And just knowing your numbers. I'd say like 3/4 of guys truly do not know their numbers forward to back. I mean, that's probably pretty low, but
yeah.
I mean, not just seed. I mean, they just do what they have to do. But I mean, really pick it. I mean, I should start. This is only like my 7th year farming. So everything I look at, I don't have any money. So like, I'm like, do I need that? Do I need that? You know, what happens if we get rid of that? So I like really scrutinize the numbers hard. And it's amazing. Every time I run my numbers and I know them, I'm shocked every time. Like, wow, we're still spending that much on that. So.
Yeah.
I think guys really need to do a deep dive and not just, everybody's got a guy. Well, I got a seed guy, got a chemical guy. And you don't really, what do I need? This? Okay, sign here. How many acres? Thanks. You know,
yeah.
And I don't blame them. It's convenient and easy. But I think that's another part of it, the peer pressure and just doing things different.
Yeah, it's a cultural, it becomes like, and Matt, you had pointed that out. It wasn't part of the culture or wasn't accepted to apply anhydrous so early, but that has changed.
James mentioned peer pressure and bushels. One thing, when people start talking to me about bushels, or they'll say, hybrid XYZ did 10 bushels better, or it was worse, or whatever, well, prove it to me. Like, prove it to me that the practices that I'm doing versus what you're doing are going to cost you more bushels or more money, because you can't, unless you did some sort of replicated side-by-side in a field, like, Let's say you did replicated fall chisel plowed bean stubble with anhydrous and you went 60 feet at a time, and then you had somebody pull in with a strip till bar and put on your fertilizer. You know, you kept something, you know, you did a true university style trial, and then you can tell me what it's making you more or less on bushels. There's no way you're going to know, and you're not going to know year to year. 2025 growing year, and listening to people as they get out of their combines and talk about their yields, they don't. There's no trend line that you can say with really anything. For the most part, they feel like fungicides pretty much paid, but that's about it. You can't really draw really any conclusions to a lot of different things, and this is another perfect year for that.
Well, and the other thing I'd say is that when you look at, like, so if we're just going to focus on what people get off on, which is bushels, you know, you look at the National Corn Grower National Yield Record, it's held by a strip tiller, David Hula out in Virginia. And then you've got guys like Kelly Garrett here in Iowa that are, you know, winning the no-till contest. I mean, what's his what was his numbers like? He's close.
I mean, there's like 10 bushel difference, not to Hula, but like to other guys in conventional tillage. I mean, it's actually some years it's the same or better.
You know, and so, when I was in the seed business, we could actually look at our plots and segregate them by tillage method. And on the Des Moines Lobe, strip tillage was, you know, in general, they were by far the winners in the best yield. So guys say bushels, they assume that they make this stuff, that it's going to be less, but it's more the fear of the change and like, oh, shit, I've got to, like, this is going to be uncomfortable to me versus what I've done for the last 30 years.
Water quality is a very, very big deal coming into the 2026 legislative session here in Iowa. And one of the arguments that I've been making the last several years is, why is it that farmers like James and Zach and I have to prove what we do is the right way or what? I'm not saying that we're even right. So we get interviewed by magazines and these podcasts and whatever it is, and we're supposed to talk about what we're doing, right?
Right.
So why is it that we have to do that, but the person that puts on the October applied anhydrous or the disrip bean stubble that cuts a gully that literally semi-loads of dirt flow out of the field, why aren't they held to a different standard? Like, why isn't media saying, hey, you know, Bob, what did you do there with that new ripper that you could get 15 loads of dirt to flow off your farm? You know, hey, John, why, you know, tell me about that October 20th anhydrous. You know, why did you do that versus the science says that side dressing, and when the corn is a foot tall or kneecap tall, or even if you wide dropped or whatever you did, that's better science. Like, prove to me the science. And I have been in so many conversations where I've really had to take a couple steps back, Brian, and reassess who I am in all this. And it's like, I am so sick of being the guy that has to prove what I'm doing. How about everybody else? You prove what you're doing. And maybe the public needs to put more scrutiny on that. Why do you do what you do, Mr. Farmer? Mm-hmm. And tell us all about what the practices are you're doing. I can prove, you know, us three are doing side dress. We all do it and kind of differently, but it's usually after the corn is at least a foot tall, we're starting side dress application with the bulk of our N is getting applied, you know, part of it with the planter or at planting time. And the science proves that that's a better way to apply N. The Iowa Corn Growers Association and the Iowa Soybean Association have done a study that says in season application of N, you know, whatever it is, anhydrous or 32% or urea or whatever it is, combined with cover crops, can reduce nitrates coming out of a tile by 45%. Now, that's our own commodities groups doing research. We're talking about pushing a 50% N reduction.
So it's probably higher.
That we can, you know, sending that downstream. And you didn't have to do much to get it. Get some cover crops out there. I'll be the first to admit I don't have it on everything. Why? Because I don't have to. But if we get, if we start getting more of that out there and more in season N and whatever, look at what we could do. And it results in more profitability because you're not flushing the N out the tile aids and down the stream. That's a conservative approach. I'm conservative and I'm a tight ass with my money. I don't want to flush my money downstream.
We should explain that side dressing and things like that, the reason that those can be so key to reducing or improving water quality is that you are getting the exact amount of nitrogen at the exact time when that plant can take it up, rather than just applying it
in season.
On the front end, and then you're wasting a lot of it. It's at that real kind of almost micro dosing or getting it there when the plant can use it. Well, that's why that's so important.
And let's talk about history on anhydrous. When anhydrous started getting brought around in what, the 50s, roughly, my grandpa used to talk about it. They side dressed anhydrous. They didn't put it on in the fall. That happened later on in what, the 70s, 80s? You know, and one of the retailers that I do business with has a picture I think it's a 70 John Deere tractor with a tank strapped on the back, probably 100 gallons, with a front mount cultivator that they revised and made it into an anhydrous bar, little shanks on it. And they'd take a truck and they'd haul the anhydrous out to the tractor, pump it on to the tank that was strapped like a backpack on the tractor. And, you know, a lot of those guys are missing appendages and eyes and whatever. You know, nobody wore any gloves. Nobody wore any goggles. But that's when we were putting on anhydrous the correct way in season when it first started coming around, post-World War II.
You know, this whole point around side dressing, why do it? Last year, you know, the waterworks had to turn on the nitrate plant. They had to ban stuff. They were already running it. On the 12th of June, they had to ban watering because they couldn't keep up with the demand of water that had a low enough nitrate level. What's insane about that is that's about the time when James and Matt and I start actually putting our nitrogen on. So we had front-loaded so much nitrogen, and the reason we wait till then is because the 10th to 15th of June is about the point where the natural nitrogen that's left in the soil, you know, especially if you're coming off bean stubble, that's about the time where you need to supplement, because a crop to V8 needs about 35 to maybe 50 pounds of nitrogen, and a lot of us, you know, like we're probably applying some with our planters to kind of spoon-feed that, and then we're going out and putting the rest of it on after that. When the exponential, you know, uptake, when a plant is there, has roots ready to suck it up, that's when we're putting it on, you know. But that's what was so insane what happened last summer, is that we had front-loaded so much. Before the crop was even really starting to take it up, we'd already gotten so much into the river before the crop was physically able to take it that, you know, we had to ban the watering of lawns in the metro. I mean, it's asinine. I don't know how anyone in this business, I don't care if you're a farmer, a retailer, you know, an industry group leader, can look, have any understanding of basic soil science and agronomy and say something is clearly wrong here.
Yeah.
So just one more thing with what Zach was saying. So then there's nitrogen management tools. What is it? Is it NREC, or what's the newest one that IDELS and Iowa State has? There's several different nitrogen management tools, and a lot of them use weather patterns and moisture levels in the soil with what the area you are in the state of Iowa. Minnesota has several tools like this too. And that can help you decide how much nitrogen to put on, but that is if you're putting it on closer to when the crop needs it. So now think about what Zach just said. The early applied hog manures, a lot of the anhydrous that got put on in the fall of 2024, when the nitrates were high down at the Des Moines level, they were getting flushed out of the tile line. And some of these people were putting on extra N in June time period. A lot of it got flown on with urea with an airplane. Now think about that on a profitability, one, a profitability scale, and two, a science scale. Profitability-wise, the science leads you to nothing, but those tools can help you, you know, provide you with ideas. You know, they were recommending right around 120 to 150 units of N for my soils, and that was the average. We put on 150-ish on some of these farms, so we had no front-loading, all available nitrogen. And then people really need to think about this, think about the science. So how do we as an industry, how do farmers defend that? If you know that it's not making you, you're losing money doing it, and it doesn't point to science, and you get the public on board with this, we are not going to be able to defend that anymore. They're going to call for regulation. If all they know is that you could put it on with better timing and it's going to be less nitrates flowing downstream. So I look at the bad. It's not us three calling for the regulations. It's the bad actors that are calling for the regulations. All you'd have to do is bring a film crew up here in October and November and document all this. I mean, can you imagine the attack ads that could go on on Facebook. I don't understand Twitter that well, but on the evening news everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, we're doing it all in broad daylight. The farm community is daring to get regulated, and that's what concerns me.
The reason that I want to dovetail off what he said with the science, because he's 100% right. The science doesn't make sense at all. But the reason people go against the science is because they have a false floor in the form of subsidized crop insurance. Because that's your get out of jail card. If you go out and you front load and you lose it and we get a rain like we did in June of 24 or what happened in 25, and the nitrogen gets flushed and your corn looks like crap, you have the option to go out and do something about it. But like I know on the Loeb in 24 when we had the record rains in northwest Iowa, a lot of guys said, hey, the crop's lost. I've got crop insurance. What would I go out and try to rectify the situation? Because they'd already spent the money, you know, ahead of time, which caused the problem.
Right.
But they're backed up with, because there's no contingencies on crop insurance when you apply your nitrogen. And so if you apply it in a time, in a place that is more risky to lose it, that's not figured into the actuarial tables, which is just completely nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Every taxpayer should be up in arms about that, in my opinion.
Another reason is the commodity groups as a whole, they just have that whole thank a farmer mentality, and everybody just thinks, oh, it can't be me, or I get sick of it, it's the golf courses. Well, there's not that many golf courses, or it's the guy fertilizing his lawn on the cul-de-sac. That's not accurate. So a lot of guys, well, it can't be me. And then, like my soapbox about the calculator, they don't know their numbers. They don't say, geez, we have a problem here. I'm applying 60 pounds more nitrogen than James. I'm running out and having to side dress. Where's that going? But commodity groups say it's not us. Water's improving. So I think it's kind of it goes back to the change. No one wants to change, but when you have a voice in your head saying, it's not us, it's not me, well, it's not me, I can't change. So I think it's 2 + 2 = 6. Like, it's just the problem just grows.
I just saw some figures out of the University of Minnesota where they, through their farm business management program that they have through the community colleges in Minnesota, they looked at the accounts of more than 1,000 cropping operations, and they found that the most profitable farms were the ones that used the least amount of nitrogen. It was like a 30% difference.
That's the net.
Yep. And so it's you know, the old thing, it's not about the maximum yield, it's about the profitability, you know, the
top
return
bushels.
On investment there.
Top bushels cost the most.
And the other thing with crop insurance is, you know, they call that a moral hazard, where you create a situation where you are actually getting rewarded for taking risks. And it's a prime example. Crop insurance had, when it was started, has great intentions.
Mm-hmm.
It is to protect us from getting decimated by extreme weather, that kind of thing. But it's become this, it's become a way for people to, on the taxpayer's dime, to take risks that they shouldn't be taking, or to farm in a way, you know, that maybe
risk-free.
And I think that's a key point. Like, a lot of people talk about, how do we get more farmers on the landscape? You know, I think intelligent regulations around things like crop insurance would slow that process down of consolidation and eliminating, you know, farm operations from this idea that you've got to hope for your neighbor to die so you can consume him, and allow for more young people, especially to be in the business, rather than, you know, kind of the geriatric controlling class that we have now. So.
Yeah.
Because I think it'd be really hard to farm 10 counties and 25,000 acres if you didn't have crop insurance, which, not saying big guys are bad, but that would give more opportunity for smaller 1,000-acre guys, and our communities would shine if you had more 1,000, you know, smaller guys.
Let's think about, instead of front-loading in the fall nitrogen, and it's a lot of that, I think, is due to fear of prices going up or peer pressure because a neighbor is doing it. Let's think about it. Let's say 2026, we have a really, really wet spring. So the argument is, let's get my nitrogen on in case it's wet. That is the absolute worst thing you could do. Because let's say you have an 80-acre farm, or maybe you have a couple hundred acres that it is so dang wet that you're not going to get it planted.
Right.
Well, why would you want 150-plus units of N even on it? Wouldn't you want to be able to say, oh, my God, thank God that I didn't spend all that extra money when I'm going to get hosed, you know, by the rain? You know, if you have your fertilizer on already, you know, that's going to be there next year. That's really not going to go anywhere unless you flush some phosphorus.
Yeah.
You know, but the N, it's the mentality that we have with N We got to be thinking about that more. And there is so much science. We don't need any more research on this. That's all just common sense. You know, if it's so wet that you can't plant and it's so wet that you can't side dress, your corn crop is screwed already. So then you just as well wait it out till the end of June and then you start making some decisions. Am I done for on this crop or, you know, what am I going to do? That's mitigating costs. Mitigating cost, which results in what losing less money and making a profit.
Some guys will put more on this fall. I guarantee it. I've heard people say, "I'm going to put another 15% down because last year we were running a little short because it was wet in my area."
Yeah.
So it's like, what?
We still, and you're not the only one. I've heard that from several different farmers. I've heard it from like implement dealers talking about their customers. You know, we're going to put on 15 to 20% more in October
to be safe.
With like an inhibitor to be safe. Well, you're spending more money than if you were just to buy 32% and side dress it and be done with it. You're spending more money. It makes no sense.
Why were you short? Like I ask guys that, and or like they say, my wide drops are so expensive. But so back to that side dress. So I have a Hagee, an older Hagee, and it's an 80-foot boom, and I have wide drops on it, which will trickle the nutrients along the row. And I think it costs like less than 10 grand, that attachment to put on. You can put on any sprayer. So it's like I have more, the first year it more than paid for itself just because I reduced my nitrogen by like 60 pounds because I'm doing in season whenever I want. With the Hagee, I could go into tasseled corn if I really wanted to. I don't want to, but you could and why drop with it? So it's like 10 in today's world of millions of dollars of equipment, like that 10 grand, that's probably the cheapest, highest ROI piece of equipment I've had on the farm. I mean, just instant.
The second part of this interview will be available on episode 396. For links to some of the research cited in this interview, and for more information on the relationship between healthy soil and clean water, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 395 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.